As was already mentioned, I am the original founder and president of the Islamophobia Register Australia. My relationship with Islamophobia, however, over the years has taken many, many forms. From being an advocate against it to becoming a victim of it and everything in between. Now I stand before you today with a heavy heart. The past few weeks and the past few days have been turbulent, to say the least. There is much that has been said about this topic already by many, and the issues that I want to speak about today won't just be speaking to those in the room, but those outside. So bear with me while I pour my heart out to you. Like Stan Grant, the issues that I want to speak about today are deeply, deeply personal. I don't have the privilege of studying or looking into these issues from an outsider's perspective or as part of an extracurricular hobby. I have lived it and I continue to experience it. I don't want to delve into a discourse about all doom and gloom, but I do want to premise my talk with this very simple fact. If you haven't walked my path, then your understanding of my circumstances is secondary. You cannot flatly deny that which you've had the privilege not to experience. Since I founded the Register in late 2014, I've effectively been at the coalface of Islamophobia. I joke about the fact that I've become the Islamophobe's favourite poster child, and the sacrificial lamb, halal of course, of the anti-Islamic movement. Now, trying to remain positive in the face of all that I've endured is no easy feat, but I thank God, my supportive family, and my psychologist for that. In recent months, the Islamophobia Register Australia has teamed up with a group of academics from varying backgrounds across Australia to analyse the data that we've collated over the past few years. We hope to release a report later in the year, first of its kind, which will include quantitative and qualitative data analysis, including details around trends, demographics of the perpetrators and that of the victims, the distribution of the events according to the months, and researching the correlation, if any, between the frequency of the reports and the socio-political environment at the time, and mapping Islamophobia hotspots. Now, Islamophobia is incredibly broad, and my message today is to those who have perpetrated, those who experience it, and those who are caught up in the shadows of these two. My message is for the backyard bigots and the backyard chefs, and everyone in between. My message is for the powerful institutions and voices of influence striding in our corridors of power, on our airwaves and on our screens, that consciously and unconsciously perpetuate it and act as enablers of it. And my message is to those who plant the seeds of Islamophobia and then benefit from the fruit that it inevitably bears. My message is also to the misguided backyard clerics who label themselves as religious guides, both the tangible ones that you can see and the intangible ones that roam our internets, the ones we refer to as Chef Google and Chef YouTube, that exploit young, impressionable souls by exploiting our holy verses and mischievously citing Islamophobia. The diverse players sucked into this vortex, many of whom unwittingly feed off each other and yet simultaneously and passionately despise one another. I call them the Islamophobes and the radicalised. And then my message to those who find themselves on the fringes of society, those most susceptible to the messages and narratives of violent political ideologies, the young souls who feel so disenfranchised, so disillusioned, that they feel compelled to turn to political ideology, and I say political, not religious ideology, that has conveniently wrapped itself in a religious cloak to gain legitimacy. Please know this, the people who you claim to be defending, representing, and fighting for are the very people who will suffer and face an enormous backlash every time you think you're doing something to help your cause. Let me remind you, whilst that there are loud and vocal voices shouting down at us in this country, which is adding to your sense of alienation, be assured that the silent majority do not hate you. In fact, many speak out. They may not all understand you, but do not lose hope and do not despair. All is not doom and gloom. This is your home just as much as it is anyone else's. For some of us, this is the only home that we've ever known. The utter irony is that all of the parties involved on each end of this extreme spectrum cling on to this false hope that their words and their actions are actually tackling and thereby reducing endemic institutionalised Islamophobia and global injustices in the case of those who are disillusioned, falling prey to radicalisation. Or in turn, on the other side, those who think that it will reduce and counter radicalisation, terrorism, or the perceived Muslim threat in the case of the Islamophobes, both at an individual and institutional level. But the reality is that their words and actions have the polar opposite impact of what they set out to achieve, and instead contributes further to fueling each other's causes. Meanwhile, everyone else is caught up in between. These are by no means the only factors at play, but it cannot be ignored, however, that political ideologies prey on disaffection. Disaffection. Whether it's the very disaffection that makes voters nod to the empty, baseless words of politicians that are void of logic, but somehow it resonates with them. Or the disaffection that pulls a young Australian Muslim man to the fringes of society, thereby making him vulnerable prey to the wicked-minded. We cannot ignore this sense of disaffection. No doubt the consequences of the latter are definitely deadly, as brainwash and radicalised young people so callously destroyed their lives and that of others. But there are parallels to be drawn between these two groups. Put simply, there are far too many disaffected and disillusioned people amongst us on both ends of the spectrum. We need to work together to bring them back into the fold. Both the ones on the right and the ones on the other side. Australia is one big family. Whilst these folks may seem like that distant cousin that you'd rather not engage, ignoring them will not make them disappear into oblivion. Ignoring them, demonising them and ridiculing them will only make them more emboldened, grant them martyr status, and create bigger pockets of polarised and disenfranchised people with devastating and long-term consequences for our nation. Whilst there are many nuances specific to Australia, the academics that we've teamed up with to draft our findings, full findings report, are noticing trends across the UK and the US in comparison to Australia and the observations of Islamophobia. Our findings to date paint a grim picture in which everyday locations, be they shopping centres, public transport hubs or on public transport itself, victims of Islamophobia are facing varying levels of verbal and physical abuse. And don't even let me get started on the online abuse that I know all too well. In the 12-month period between 18 September 2014 to 18 September 2015, there was an average of 5.4 incidents reported per week of Islamophobia. When we conducted a preliminary analysis of the data from the register, there were noticeable spikes reported following certain events, and none of these are surprising to those in this room. The spikes that we saw included in the day of the immediate aftermath of the 2015 anti-terror raids, Federal Parliament's short-lived proposal to ban the burqa in Parliament because there's so many people wearing niqabs and burqas walking into Parliament, the Martin Place siege, Tony Abbott's national security statement where he said he'd heard Western leaders describe Islam as a religion of peace and that he wished more Muslim leaders would say it and mean it. And the Australia-wide Reclaim Australia rallies. These are the times where we would see spikes in incidents of Islamophobia. Political rhetoric being an important one of those. Of particular concern is the fact that our data contains in it an alarming number of incidents in which young children are involved. I want you to pause and reflect on this. Many of you may have children. I want you to think about them. Think about a young boy who witnesses his mother, his sister, his aunt being verbally or physically abused in this manner. There's been pretty much no research that I'm aware of that looks into Islamophobia and the impact that it has on young children. Now think of a 12-year-old. A 12-year-old boy witnessing his mother being verbally abused. Then he goes to school and gets called a terrorist in the playground. The day after, Pauline Hanson appears on Q&A. Fast forward a few years, this same kid struggles to find a job because his name is Muhammad. Research has shown us that the Australian Muslim community has higher than average levels of education, but lower than average levels of employment. Imagine this same kid as a young adolescent. How does he feel? And then contemplate on how easy it will be for someone to brainwash him into potentially joining groups who will promise him a job, brotherhood, and a sense of belonging that his home country can't provide to him. About a year or two ago, when I started working in this space, I said that Islamophobia is at risk of becoming normalised. Ladies and gentlemen, in my humble view, we are there. It has become normalised. It's a pervasive cancer that keeps rearing its ugly head both in public and private places all too frequently. Any such discussion of Islamophobia cannot ignore the institutional, social, legal and historical power relations, political rhetoric, government policies and media framings that continue to contribute to it becoming normalised. The dog whistling and the fear mongering of conservative politicians sitting on the hard right and often the silent complicity of their leaders have played a role in helping to create fertile ground for the re-emergence of One Nation. With approximately 500,000 plus votes and counting, Pauline Hanson's One Nation received the biggest national Senate vote following major parties and that of the Greens. And perhaps the greatest paradox lies in their inappropriately titled name. They've sought to divide the nation with their ill-informed and ill-researched views. However, we must find the delicate balance between calling out their fabrications and their hate speech, but not by stooping to their levels, not by demonising and writing off all One Nation supporters as mere bigots, because not all 500,000 plus people who voted for them fit that profile. And there's no doubt that One Nation is riding the populist wave with their carefully targeted policies and rhetoric, seeking to appeal to the heart of the disaffected voter base. We know that One Nation's key policy platform was explicitly anti-Muslim. What was most concerning is their policy to outright ban Muslims from entering this country because of the perceived threat of terrorism. I mean, why would you let a good dog whistle get in the way of the facts? Never mind that when you plot the two variables, the percentage of a country's population that are Australian Muslims and the number of terrorist acts in that country in a scatter diagram, there is no obvious connection and no such trend. But why would you let the facts get in the way of that? This is precisely why last week a group of us launched factcheckonenation.com.au. We had our work cut out for us. Lots of sleepless nights trying to get that website launched in time for Q&A. We believe that a multifaceted approach is required to tackle the misinformation and xenophobia that is increasingly on the rise. Separating fact from fiction is a good starting point to counter the fear and mistrust being peddled in the community, but it's not always enough. In the US, research carried out by the Northwestern University shows that feeling dehumanised by another group can lead you to dehumanise them in return, which can increase support for aggressive actions against them. So in the context of America, where this study was done, think, if Americans think that Muslims see them as savages, Americans are more likely to return that favour by perceiving Muslims to be savages, and both groups are more likely to then support aggressive acts like drone strikes or torture against the other. This is why many, in the face of rising Islamophobia, have cautioned against such a rise, because it could validate extremist perceptions that Americans or Westerners, or anyone for that matter, are waging a war on Islam. In fact, it was Secretary of State John Kerry who has said that Donald Trump's statements calling for a ban of Muslims into America, now we've seen that echoed in Australia, that it can endanger national security by handing ISIS and other terrorists a recruitment tool. That's a quote from the Secretary of State. So research has shown us that feeling dehumanised by another group can actually lead you to dehumanising that group, and that pattern of mutual aggression continues. How is this relevant, you ask? When people like Sonia Kruger can so casually call for the banning of Muslims from entering into this country, when national newspapers like The Australian can publish comments from leaders calling for the internment of Muslims, so that's throwing everyone, all Muslims, into detention camps, that's what that means. When political parties get elected into parliament almost exclusively on their anti-Muslim policy platforms, a process of dehumanisation is taking place. When nothing we say or do, no amount of facts or statistics can sway certain segments from their hardline, wholly manufactured views about us, a process of dehumanisation is taking place. When you impress...
with a renewed and genuine intent to listen.
This has to come from the heart. It has to be with an intention to listen, to understand, not with an intention to listen, to reply. Let the reasonable voices unite and let us expend our energies into trying to inject love and compassion into a world that is being increasingly filled with destruction and despair. For the forces that bind us together are much stronger than those forces that are pulling us apart. And when we lose hope, as I sometimes do, let us look down at the face of our future generations, reflect on their futures, reflect on our hopes and dreams, and pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and light that damn candle again. For darkness does not drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariano. We have a first question from Twitter. Your thought on the hashtag Send Forgiveness viral and many Muslim views that is silencing and ineffective.
I think we need to understand that there are many ways to respond. Sending forgiveness is one of them, and an incredibly important component of that. I had a conversation with Wally Dali last night about his campaign and how moved I was by it, because what resonated with me is that it's enshrined and embedded in our faith. We are being demonized for being Muslims, and what better way to respond is through your faith. That does not mean, and Waleed Ali certainly didn't try and suggest this, that it means that we excuse those who are bigots and those who peddle these views in the community, be they politicians or the backyard bigots. You can call that out, but you can do it respectfully. Where do we go with this if we're constantly shouting each other down? Where do we go if all that is consuming us is the hate being peddled from either side? There's no constructive debate in that. We need an opportunity and a platform for those really vital voices to come out, the ones that speak about embedded institutional Islamophobia. We need a platform for those voices to be heard. But it has to be done in a way that is compassionate. Because, as I said, the voices on both sides of the spectrum, whether it's those of the disaffected One Nation voters or disaffected young Muslim men, we need to reach out to those voters, to those voices. And I'm not saying that the onus is on me as a person from the Australian Muslim community who's already going through so much. The onus is not on me to have to prove to others why we are not terrorists. The onus is on all of us, the reasonable voices in our community, to stand up, to hold our hand, to stand in solidarity and speak out, and not through tokenism and merely through hashtags, but in the barbecue conversations, the conversations you have while you're filling up your bottle of water in the office. Be brave enough to speak out and to speak up. And what that involves is going beyond the tokenism, looking into the reasons why Islamophobia is able to take hold and the historical constructs around that. But we can do that with compassion.
Okay, now a question from the audience. Yes, one? Yeah, this is you, sir.
Thank you so much for your speech today. It was very powerful. My question is, we're at a human rights conference and a lot of the speakers are talking about issues outside of the legal framework. So I'm wondering, given the work that you've done with the register and the work that you're doing in social media, has the formal human rights framework failed? Or, like many proponents say, is it better than not?
Thank you for your question, and you're right. I have spoken extensively on this issue. Unfortunately, I felt today coming here with, you know, the enormous and exceptional circumstances of the past week that I had to talk more about those issues. In terms of the legal framework, you know, you say, isn't it better than nothing or something to that effect? And yeah, it is. It is. But what standard do we expect and what standard do we accept? If this is a standard that allows this kind of xenophobia to take hold and to become, for Islamophobia to become normalised, then we have to say maybe that standard is not good enough. I've often had this discussion and raised issues around the inadequate protections afforded to minority groups. The fact that the current existing laws, be it state or federal, with probably the exception of Victoria, you guys seem to do everything much better than most of us, that the laws are inadequate. They apply disproportionately to minority groups, where certain segments and certain faith groups are protected and others are not. And I'm not suggesting a black and white answer. What I'm suggesting is let's have that conversation. Let's get the experts in the room and consider whether changes need to be made to our existing laws to strengthen them. But you know why I don't talk about that anymore? Because there's no political appetite or political will. Because I'm shouted down by the conservative voices in the media who just want to paint us as all extremists. So it's like we can't even have those sophisticated conversations because we get pulled back into the conversation around Muslims don't contribute, or that somehow we're uncivilized, or that we're terrorists and that we should be banned. We get pulled back into these conversations. I would love for the conversation around Australian Muslims to mature, but I'm afraid right now I don't see that happening.
Yeah, I have a question. Hi, I'm Deanna from Amnesty International, and I just wanted to commend your bravery today. It's not an easy topic at all to speak so heartfully about, so thank you for that. My question is about how you mentioned the dehumanisation process and how it's already begun, and you know, we can sit here in despair about it and see what the media is portraying, and frankly I think is quite irresponsible. However, you know, working at a human rights organisation, I don't want us to sit here in despair. I want to think of ideas and innovative ideas and how we can engage with progressive leaders in the community and amplify their voices and give them the platform, because all we're seeing, particularly on, you know, Q&A on Monday night was quite, you know, symptomatic of that, where there were just no alternative voices that could speak to this issue, much like what you're doing here today. And how do we make that part of mainstream dialogue and encourage people who have these progressive moderate views, which I feel actually are the majority, and really amplify their voices? And if you have some ideas on how we could do that, that would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I think what can help start that is for us to have a broader conversation that stops labelling Australian Muslims into categories. And this is not something that people always do consciously, something that often happens unconsciously, but by labelling Muslims into categories and putting them into the buckets of moderates and progressives and extremists and radicals, we're helping create that further divide. The reality is that we have to understand that someone who you may classify as a moderate Muslim isn't someone who's moderately practicing. They are the true Muslims. So by labelling them as moderates and the other end as extreme, you are suggesting that this bucket being defined as the extreme Muslim is still practising a form of Islam. So the first thing is the framing. And then it's about listening to those voices that you might think are radical, but truly understanding what they're saying and what is at the core of it. And that's not to say that we should, particularly when, you know, there are voices out there, because of the categorisation, we don't actually hear the substance of what they're saying. And the reality is lots of things have been said. I'm often invited to government roundtables where we ask for our views on things. And we talk to, you know, we've been asked the question of how do you stop radicalisation, and how, like, as if I have the answer. But maybe part of that is that the things that have been echoing from the Australian Muslim community for many, many years centres around all these issues around foreign policy, around Islamophobia, around the policing, around dehumanisation, and all of the things that Anne Arnie spoke about earlier. But the way that that's then reported in the media, who's always looking for a headline or a soundbite, it gets lost. It gets lost, and they then suggest that we are suggesting that somehow terrorism is excused, but it's not. How do we get out of this situation? I don't have that answer. But I think part of it is about all of us taking responsibility, and not just people like me. All of us have a responsibility. Terrorism is a global problem. I myself have received indirect threats from extremist groups, including ISIS. Every time I go out and say something publicly. So people say, you don't speak out enough. We don't hear from you. Do you have any idea the personal cost associated with what I'm doing? These are the things that are ignored.
Lady with the white dress, just one last question.
It's a little bit similar, sorry. Just into the one from Ross Leffen. One of the things that I'm particularly passionate about is education around cultural and linguistic diversity in the workplace. And from what you're saying, there is so much that everyone can do, not just a us and them dichotomy. Do you have some practical resources, given that you're talking to a room of advocates, that we can use in these conversations to talk about the diversity in our community and to start to change those discussions? I know you talked about the barbecue discussions, but also education is power, and bringing awareness to where those resources are to the broader community, I think, is also fundamental to changing discussion.
Thank you for your question, and you're right. Those who know me personally know that I'm constantly buzzing with ideas, and we should do this and we should do that, and I get up in the middle of the night and I have to write things down because I'm like, I'm going to forget that in the morning. I have so many ideas about what we could potentially be doing, but the problem is we don't have the resourcing. There are grassroots initiatives that we could be doing. There are ways to tackle these issues through education, and particularly in the area of Islamophobia. Where we're seeing it at its worst is online. And it's through that online resource and through social media that we can then educate others around it. So whether it's, you know, 6-minute videos or 1-minute videos that tackle and break down these issues, that speak to the everyday garden variety Australian, that speaks to them about these issues and helps them sift through the fiction and separate the fiction from the facts. Those are the kind of things, and I'm happy to have, you know, more of a detailed conversation around other ideas that I have. And it's about what I've been trying to do in the past week as well, is team up with other organisations outside of the Australian Muslim community to see what we can be doing collectively, because this is something that we all need to own. Because one nation is not going away, whether it's demonising our Indigenous population or demonising our Asian Australians, and now it's just simply our turn. This is not going away. We need to find a constructive way to tackle it together.
Get any last question?
Question was about, you spoke about how One Nation appeals generally upon an emotional level, and they use fear and emotional appeals to kind of kind of support with this kind of bigotry. Which you counter, like you said, with fact-checking and with the register, do you find that it's difficult to bridge the gap and reach people with fact and reason when the fear is provoked on a purely emotional level, and what can be done to kind of counter that?
I think the fact-checking is one aspect of it, and we acknowledge that in the media release we issued, that it's merely one aspect. The way that I see the situation is that there are people that sit on either end of the extreme, and those voices, you can't reason with them. Facts don't necessarily sway them, or statistics won't sway them. But what you can do is reason with the people that are just closest to those. You can start reaching out to those voices. And through the conversations that are later had, whether they're at barbecues or in the pubs, they can then reach those more, what we would call extreme voices. And you're right, it is about emotion. And because it's about emotion, that's why I'm not afraid to show my emotion. I can't really help it either. But to show the personal side and the cost of Islamophobia and the impact it has personally. Because that's emotion. That's saying to people that you're not just demonising this unknown entity. You're not just demonising a homogenous blob of people who you don't know. You're demonising someone like me. And by introducing that human element to it, you can help change people's views. That's why I keep going back on Twitter despite the hate. Because over the years, people have gotten to know me, the flaws in my personality and everything, but they've got to know me as an individual. Some people who would never engage with an Australian Muslim, and you know, the most contact they've had is to see them on television or walk past one and assume a whole bunch of things. But the interactions they can have with someone online can help, even if just a little, change that view that they've held on to for so long.